Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Bruno Barron, Mark Casello, John McDonough, and Mike Miller. Program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Happy St. Patrick's Day to you forever you're listening from coast to coast and border to border. Our program, our phone lines are now open toll free at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, we're going to be talking about a variety of things this evening. In the second hour of our broadcast, for those listening on radio, we're going to be talking about school reform and school choice and things of that nature, all about education in hour number two this evening. But again, we begin this week by talking about what's in the news today. Speaker Boehner was on one of the Sunday morning shows, and he's saying, well, there's no immediate crisis here. We can probably work around some of these fiscal issues. And so let me ask you, Mike Miller from DePaul University, you're an economist. Would you agree with the speaker that maybe there's been this sky is falling attitude that has come really from Republicans and Democrats for the last couple of months? Is this now, do they now have to have a little crow because the country is not closed down yet?
I think more the Democrats have to eat the crow, partly because of what the president did regarding sequester, that was going to be the end of the world. But even I think the Republicans have argued all along that the real trouble is further out with regard to Medicare and Social Security. And those are the entitlement programs. If they are not somehow revised or revisited, we're in very big trouble when it comes to the budget. We're moving in the right direction. The economy is beginning to grow a little bit faster. Jobs are being made. So the percentage of GDP that is the national or the deficit's getting smaller, which is moving in the right direction. But it's just everything is in the near future. We have to deal with it.
John McDonough is one of our Democrats tonight. John, the Republicans and Speaker Boehner, and Republicans have been standing fast on this, that when we talk about the fiscal situation, you can forget about revenue. There's going to be no more increased revenues. Do you buy that?
It's hard for me to buy it because no economist seems to buy it. But this is one of those.
But do you think they're going to stand fast on that?
Well, until they choose not to. There are ways to compromise these things. There are ways to make increased revenue seem like something else. There's the whole issue of tax loopholes and various tax deductions that could be adjusted without raising tax rates. There are many ways to, disguise, your intentions and get an adequate result.
Bruno Barron also joined us. Bruno, nice to have you with us.
Thanks a lot. It's great to be on.
The successful and almost the euphoric response that Senator Rand Paul got at the GOPAC convention this past week.
Right.
Does that signal to you that there isn't an inch for any Republican to maneuver around their pledge not to raise revenues?
No, I think the Republicans could raise, they could make a deal, and I think it would be better for the country. I think both parties have to, they have to do something to placate their wings, their extreme wings, and I think both parties have extreme wings in them, both have extreme positions. But if the right deal was made, and that deal would have to put Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security some sort of fix on the table, I think anything that was a $2 of increase for $5 or $6 of cuts. Let's put it this way, and maybe Tea Party people will call in and yell at me for being on the right side of the aisle and saying this. But if there was a $1 tax increase for $5 of real, not fake, not gamed, but real spending cuts, the Republicans would be idiots not to take it.
Mark Casello also joins us. He is the closest thing to a Democrat, but you are not a traditional Democrat. You are more of a Occupy Wall Street Democrat. You've been critical of the president. When Rand Paul was leading the filibuster about the drone attacks, I would assume you were cheering him.
Yeah, I think he captured, for different reasons, this sentiment that there's an overreach of presidential power. So I think when you saw the Occupy demonstrations, there were a lot of Ron Paul followers back then. And so, but for different reasons, the Occupy people, they're not so much concerned about this abstract constitutionality argument that Rand Paul was making. They're more concerned about the human cost, the expansion of imperial power into other countries, national sovereignty.
Does Rand Paul expand the base of the Republican Party?
I think there's a growing libertarian strand to the Republican Party, and that's where you're going to see some growth. In the CPAC convention, I don't think you saw a radical change or rebranding of the conservatism. I saw sort of a doubling down on some of the same principles. I was surprised that they didn't go after immigration reform or talk about it or create this new image of the Republicans as more open tent. So I think they're going to have a hard time growing the party, and Rand Paul might be a way for them to do it, but it's going to make the party more extreme.
Mike, do you think that Rand Paul represents an opportunity to expand the base of the party, or do you think he's narrowing it?
I think he expands it in that libertarians oftentimes were torn whether they would vote Republican or should I vote libertarian. And I think he has the chance of bringing in the libertarian side of that. And so in some sense, that would expand the party. That would give them a few more thousand votes here and there in terms of each precinct and or hundreds, and that might be just enough to push you over.
He won the straw poll, which, again, right. There'll be 1,500 straw polls between now and 2016. But, again, Marco Rubio finished second, and he chose not to bring up immigration reform as a
right.
as an issue at this particular convention, realizing that it may not his position may not be a terribly popular position.
I flew in and flew out of CPAC briefly, and I was working with a few people there and met some friends of mine. And I saw Jeb Bush.
So you missed 70 speeches?
Yes, gladly. And I mean, I like CPAC. It's nice, but there's things you do there and there's things you don't there. And going to the never-ending speeches is
a lot of drinking there, isn't there?
Yeah, and I did not partake in very much of that either. But I did see Jeb Bush, and I was surprised at the support that he had in the room, the number of cheers and claps that he got. When you talk to some people, they would roll their eyes because I think there's something in the party that doesn't want to see the third. When the last three GOP presidents all had the same last name, there's a natural aversion to that among voters. But the fact is, this guy gave a great speech, and he could be elected president. The idea that the establishment is dead and the Rand Paul wing is taking over is it's not that it isn't there isn't something like that going on, but it's not, you know, the rumors of the demise of the GOP establishment are greatly exaggerated.
What about were you surprised at Marco Rubio, or do you fear that Rubio may be moving too fast, too far, and
faster than Barack Obama, perhaps?
But I'm just talking about peaking within the Republican Party.
No, I think there's a great deal of talent in the party, governors and senators.
No, just moving too fast politically.
No, I don't think he's moving too fast politically.
Yep. All right, we're going to pause. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we'll continue that discussion. If you want to weigh in on what you saw or heard out of the CPAC convention, you can do that. But we're also going to be continuing our discussion about the fiscal problems facing the United States of America. Back shortly with your calls. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. And during the break, John McDonough was talking about the notoriety of Rand Paul and the visibility that he received during the filibuster over the drones. And again, it's been a couple of weeks because we were on tape last week, but you've got some strong feelings on the drones and whether the story was overblown.
Well, first of all, I'm glad to hear that when you go on vacation, you can unplug yourself from all this controversy. But on the drone thing, The whole Rand Paul debate seemed to center, as far as the news coverage was concerned, on this notion that we were going to have drones, falling on Americans in various parts of the country. And I mean, the whole idea of the drone, if I understand it correctly, is to go into enemy areas where you can't land a ground army. Here in the United States, you have police power. You have all the power you need to deal with any kind of a domestic issue. I mean, even when they went after the SLA, they sent police in. They didn't send, B-52s in.
There was discussion, though, that the drones would be in the air. They may not be armed. But mm-hmm. Would you have any problem with the drones being in the air?
Well, for what purpose?
To watch you.
For catching me going through a stoplight? Yes.
You tell me, actually, for what purpose. I'm not the one putting them in the air. Yeah. I just wonder, why would we want to have drones in the air of the United States? I don't know if I want Big Brother watching me almost literally.
Mike?
Yeah, the issue I raised was that, if Barack Obama wasn't the president, wouldn't there be more outrage from the people on the left?
Of course there would be.
I mean, if George Bush was authorizing military strikes to assassinate American citizens without trial, that's a big issue. And I think Rand Paul was raising the specter of what happens, with the next presidency or 10 years down the line for setting this precedent. And I think that was a valid issue to raise. In addition, the fact that President Obama was not able to close Guantanamo Bay as he said he was going to, he carried on a lot of the same policies of the Bush administration. It's left many on the left and the libertarian wing suspicious, I think duly so, of some of our security policy. But getting back to John's question, to point, at the same time, a drone strike, if you look at in Pakistan, we've killed approximately 400 civilians. The Iraqi ground war report came out this week. They estimate 135,000 civilians were killed there.
Is there a scenario, Bruno, mm-hmm. when drone surveillance or an attack, if need be, is warranted in the United States? Can you think of a scenario?
Unfortunately, and this is, it makes me nervous to say this, I think you could think of thousands of scenarios. I mean, we have red light cameras everywhere. We have security cameras everywhere. I was just rushing to get here, and I was on lower Wacker, and there's so much technology strapped to those posts. They can get your picture. They can figure out how fast you're going. So the fact is, we already live in a de facto surveillance state. All they have to do is it's like that show Person of Interest that's on Channel 2 if people like it. All they have to do is flip all the integration of this stuff on, and you won't be able to walk from place to place without being under surveillance. So will they put drones in the air to watch us first and then maybe report on us second and then maybe shoot us third or fourth or fifth down the line? I think the slippery slope arguments, everybody uses that as a derogatory phrase when in fact there is a lot of times that the slippery slope has happened. So I think I think people on the left and the right are appropriately concerned about what might happen here.
But Eric Holder, if he wanted to, he could have slammed this discussion. He could have nailed this discussion mm-hmm. short, and he didn't do that.
He didn't do it.
He was an attorney. He's a lawyer, and a question was put to him, and he, like lawyers do, he wanted to look at all the angles of the question. He did end his answer
Isn't he political though too?
Well, yes, but I mean he's political, but the point is you want to look at all the angles of the question. That's what his instincts are programmed to do. And in the end, he did say, "I think I said no." And then that was followed up with a document which supported that. No, it was a clear the congressman wanted a yes or no answer. And as anybody who knows about congressional committees, nobody gets a yes or no answer.
Let's go to Ann in Algonquin, Illinois, listening to us on WLS Radio. Go ahead. You're on the air.
I think you're absolutely right, Bruce. I think the whole reason for Rand Paul's filibuster speech had to do with the fact that neither Eric Holder or anyone from the Obama administration would just come right out and say, first of all, that they were not going to target civilians, and whether or not it would even be constitutional. And they would not give an answer until very, very late in the game. So I think his speech was absolutely necessary. Hello?
Yes. Do you think though, Ann, in context, I think this is one of the things that John was talking about, in context to what the fiscal problems that the country is facing, Was this a diversion of discussion, and should more discussion be made on some of the fiscal matters? Was it sort of a smokescreen for almost a couple of weeks that really wasn't even necessary because nobody believes it's really going to happen?
Well, it's one thing to say we're not going to believe something's going to happen. We've seen a number of things happen that I think even the majority of the population did not believe was going to happen, whether it was with Obamacare or just all kinds of other situations since Barack Obama took office in 2008. So I don't think that would be a valid consideration whatsoever. There was no reason to believe, other than what had been coming from the Obama administration regarding the drone issue, and Rand Paul was just looking for a one simple, honest answer, and as a result of his speech, I think we did get it. Now, whether they hold to that, that's something else again.
Can I ask go ahead. How do you feel about this, to take the issue way down to the bottom, how do you feel about the idea of red light cameras being installed on half the street corners in Chicago and, in effect, mechanizing the enforcement of trivial traffic laws? Do you object to that, or do you feel that people should obey the law?
I think Ann is gone, but
let me
ask you the question, because you're talking about parking tickets,
yes,
but also in many parts of the south and west sides of Chicago, and in some areas on the north side of Chicago, which includes Caucasian or white communities in addition to Hispanic and black communities. For those people listening around the country and don't know what those designations mean, there is also the blue light cameras, which are looking at these streets. But the question is, if you live in a crime-infested area, what is wrong with the blue light cameras if they reduce crime?
Crime in crime-infested areas is not the result of people parking their cars and doing red lights.
Let's extract the traffic safety.
And there seems to be political support for that. I mean, no politician has suffered as a result of this infestation of surveillance.
So the question is, if you live in a crime, again, we're not talking about parking tickets or speeding tickets, because again, I've paid my share of little red light cameras because I pushed the yellow light a little bit too far, or defined the yellow light a little bit more than the police have. But my question is, if you live in one of these neighborhoods, you say the people are not screaming and yelling about having these cameras taken out, so don't they want them there?
Well, I would say this. I mean, talking to people and having lived in high crime areas, what I want to see are just human beings walking the streets and getting to know people. A blue light camera, it sends a message as you pass through to tourists and things that this is a high crime zone. It sends the wrong message.
What's wrong with that?
Well, it connotes that this community is not safe. And I think Chicago is struggling with gun violence. We don't want to send a message out where every other block you drive down, you're at a flashing light. It creates panic. I drove some...
less expensive than officers on the street.
Well, but we have officers in nice SUVs in Chicago driving around burning lots of fossil fuels. We can get those officers out on the beat, I think, retire their vehicles, get them walking around, meeting the people, take those cameras down.
This would be an area of agreement that I have with a progressive Democrat. The issue becomes in all of these areas is that we have this increasingly chaotic society that it's literally not working in some areas. And instead of actually working on the things to fix them, we just continue to make the problems worse and worse, whether it's more technology, more bureaucracy, more laws, and more rules, instead of getting down to the nitty-gritty and finding out what's really good for these communities. Sometimes the answer is not more spending and it's not more government power. It's just diverting and reallocating resources so that you actually start solving the problems instead of just papering them over with more technology and laws.
Well, I think some of these blue light cameras might have made a better name for themselves if they'd have helped to track down some of these shooters that we hear so much about around town. But to my knowledge, they haven't really single one. It's just speeders and red light guys.
I in principle have no particular problem with surveillance if the target is serious crime, violent crime.
Mike,
I think we may all end up agreeing, but I It just something rubs me wrong. I've just been, in all my lifetime, I've never read 1984, and I've been reading it. Mm-hmm. And it's just scary to think of Big Brother and everywhere. Now, the only, of course, in that book, it's in your room, it's in your house, and so forth. But I know that we have no expectation.
Isn't it in our room, in our house now, because the government phones? Has the ability to
yes.
listen in on every phone conversation.
Yes, they can. And
save every email, look at every email, look at every Twitter. I mean, aren't we already there?
And it bugs me. That's the libertarian side. I'm a Republican, but I have these libertarian leanings, and it just really, really bugs me.
The idea of 1984 was the government getting inside your head.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't see this technology at that threshold today.
Boy,
you're
awfully optimistic.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead. Well, yeah. let's a little bit of government inside your head.
I think if I were to put the icing on the cake here with everything all of us are saying, I think all the left and the right needs to sit back a little bit and see whether or not we can't roll back the frontiers of the state, not just economically and not just culturally, but just basically. And the answer, I think, goes back to what can we do to make Americans more self-governing so that they don't need to be governed by this ruling class of corporate weasels and bad politicians.
We'll follow up with that when we come back. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border every Sunday night. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. Tonight we have Mark Casella is here. He is with St. Joseph College of Calumet College of St. Joseph. And he is a professor of radical English. And also joining us this evening is Bruno Berendt. He is the executive director of For the Good of Illinois. And in the second hour of this evening, we're going to be talking about his pet topic, which is a school choice and vouchers and things of that sort. John McDonough is here. You hear him periodically on public radio as a contributor for All Things Considered and Morning Edition. And also, he is the editor of the Encyclopedia of Television, published by the Museum of Broadcast
Communication.
Advertising, that's right. We've done a couple, but advertising, and again, spent many years in the advertising world and also with the Chicago Tribune. Also joining us this evening is Mike Miller. He is an associate professor of economics for many years at DePaul University, and they join us tonight. We'll continue our discussion in just a moment. After I mention that I've talked about this for the last couple of weeks, this coming Saturday, March 23rd, the museum is going to celebrate the 89th anniversary of the WLS National Barn Dance. That's the program that introduced country music to most of America on the radio in the 1920s. And it's a very important program in the history of American broadcasting. But what makes it very unique is that the building where all that started at 1230 West Washington Boulevard is still there. And the studio where that program originated from is still there. It's only going to be there for less than a month from now. It's going to be the studio itself is going to be dramatically transformed because of a change in ownership of the building. But next Saturday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we're going to go into the very studios on the third floor where the WLS National Barn Dance took place. I walked through there again on Friday afternoon. You know where you can see where the control rooms are. You can see where the talent used to be. You can see where the offices are. It's a step back in not only radio history, but again, if you like country music, we're going to have Steve Perry, who is a documentarian, who's done a documentary called The Hayloft Gang. We've got people from the Old Town School of Music. We have probably four or five of the leading experts on the history of country music and also on the history of the WLS Barn Dance. Again, it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And again, you can go to our website, museum.tv. It is a benefit for the Radio Hall of Fame. It's $89, 89th anniversary. It was on WLS, $890, and it's $89. So just think of $89. There'll be some light refreshments. And again, if you're interested in radio and country music history, again, it'll be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to celebrate. And then just a few days later, that place is going to be changed forever. During the break, we were talking, Bruno, you were leading a discussion about a pet topic. And as you were talking, some of our left-of-center guests were sort of nodding. So there may be an element of agreement with some of the things that you're about to say.
Well,
we're going to turn the microphone to you again.
See if I can remember what it was exactly I was saying that you liked. But I think what I used the word corpocracy. And it's like a corporate power combined with the power of the state, combined with the ability to lobby to keep down your competitors and to get copyright laws the way you want it, the way Disney's done, and various things like this that are leading us not just into whether or not we should do drones or whether or not there's too many police cameras or anything like that. It's that what's happening is that a certain strata of people are getting more and more power and more rights at the expense of all of the rest of us and our power and our rights and, quite frankly, our ability to govern ourselves.
Who's getting the rights?
I think there's a fantastic article by a guy named Andrew Cotovella who talked about what he called the ruling class versus the country class. And he said these are corporate chieftains, cultural chieftains, news chieftains. And that article was probably a little bit more right versus left than I'm even trying to talk about here. I'm talking about there are people who it would be better for me if I would have all the power and I would have all the money and you could just go into debt and spend a lot of time in debt and earning very little money.
You mentioned an interesting example of H&R Block in your conversation?
Yeah, H&R Block and Intuit, two companies which I think all of us were seeing all their commercials right now, they specifically lobbied for IRS regulations to say that if you were an independent tax preparer, you had to go out and do continuing legal education. And I think, fortunately, a federal judge said, no, this is restraint of trade, and I think they got that tossed. SOPA, the act that has to do with in regulation of the internet and all kinds of other things.
So under
over
the camouflage of consumer protection,
right,
they are in effect kind of trying to exclude all their competitors from the field.
So you have to buy into it or go to H&R Block.
You know, in a way, it seems to me analogous to the anti-abortion lobby, which under the guise of patient protection is enforcing all kinds of legislative standards on abortion clinics and thus making it impossible for them to
Mike Miller,
continue.
Are you concerned about this?
I am. I'm concerned, to use that trite phrase, it's trite. It's not trite. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And giving more power to either corporations or to government, to me, is something that I fear. And I just do not like – I know when I leave the house that I have no assumption that I have privacy. But I think that the amount of privacy I've lost is it's getting too far.
And Mark Casella, these Republicans tonight are singing your tune, are they not?
They are. They're not welcome to the Occupy Wall Street movement, guys.
No, the big difference is they want me to pay for their schooling and so forth, and I'm not willing to do that.
No, well, it's a polyvocal movement, but actually Bruno was articulating very well one of the big concerns was that there is a concentration of power. Corporations and individuals who seek to enforce their power upon others at the expense of others, and they're not behaving in a traditional productive capitalist model where they're discouraging entrepreneurship, things that have happened with Monsanto and the right for farmers to grow their own seed has been infringed. So these kinds of issues on both sides of the aisle, I think, are concerning.
You have described the class and the elites that are gaining all these additional rights and gaining all of this additional power. Who is being left behind? Are they people that don't care? Are they people who are uneducated, or are they somebody else? Who's being left behind?
I think a lot of it. I think it's a very, very broad group of people, and it's on both sides of the political spectrum. You could say, first of all, I think people who actually work for a living, the people who, whether they're white collar or blue collar, that they have a job where they show up and they're supposed to work. I think they're being left behind. They have to, it's harder and harder for them to achieve that American dream that they're talking about. And for those who are still safe achieving that American dream, there's two or three that have lost jobs that, quite frankly, may never be coming back for a wide variety of technological reasons that might not be anybody's specific fault. But if
the American dream a myth today?
No, I actually think that we're right. If we turn the correct direction, I think we can re-achieve so much that all sides of the aisle, we can probably agree on this. And if we turn the wrong direction, I think we may start going the way of what we saw in Cyprus and what's happening in Greece. So, you know, who really knows? But I think that there's a broad strata of people. If you go back to the campaign, Barack Obama talked about Julia, somebody who is literally taken care of cradle to grave. It's almost like we want to create a class of people that have to be taken care of cradle to grave, as opposed to what I think the libertarian kind of conservative dream would be that most of us could actually grow up to understand the world around us so that we could govern ourselves.
But cradle to grave creates dependence, creates power
in
those that are perpetuating. And, John, do you agree with that?
Well, I was thinking that...
And do you support that?
Well, I mean, in a way, yes. I mean, let me just back up and talk about classical Jeffersonian liberalism, which saw the government as the principal threat to individual liberty.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the Industrial Revolution, and you had the rise of, you know, collective private power. And that superseded the government threat. So classical liberalism sort of shifted its ground and became New Deal liberalism and used government to try and control private power. Now, what you're suggesting is almost that private power has corrupted or co-opted public power through influence and lobbying and
regulatory capture,
mm-hmm.
and you're seeing it everywhere, and it's not just like corporations are too powerful. It's like there's, you know, NGOs, big labor, big government, big business, their bigness and their ability to play the game and all the rules. I mean, the bank issue wasn't a big, horrible capitalistic banking system that turned us all wrong. It was a horribly corrupt insider banking system that had been writing their own regulations through people like Dodd-Frank and the Republicans who were in power before them.
So it's influence versus people without influence.
Yes.
That's what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm. But
Mike?
Go ahead. I'm doing fine.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, the other thing, too, is it's we like to point towards people, but there's sort of an abstract thing at work behind here that's not a face. There's not a person to point to. We've set up structures that have allowed this influence to sort of exert itself. You have shareholder value driving a lot of these corporate decisions. There's not really a framework in place other than consumer choice to sort of get out there and sort of reshape the structure of our economic system. The way it needs to be done. But as Bruno alluded to earlier, when you have a corporocracy that's changing the way we speak about issues, that can buy time on the media and change the way we think, then it's really hard to resist that power.
When we are talking about those that have the power and those that are losing the power, obviously at some point it comes down to those that are dependent on government for a variety of services. And we get to a particular point as to how do these services get paid for, which means you have people that are promising things to generations of people, and they don't do the math out front. So we run them to the economic crisis that we have right now. And when we come back, I want to come back to sort of what's happening right now. Again, you had Speaker Boehner say today on one of the Sunday shows that, you know, there's not an immediate crisis, fiscal crisis, but there's one looming and it's got to be addressed. I want to bring it back to where we are right now and what could be done about it. And most importantly, if things are going to be lost, who gets kicked off the bus first? Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. Before the break, I asked if we're going to address some of the fiscal issues that are before us. Do there have to be some people that are kicked off the bus, or at least their expectation of what government can provide them has to be reduced? And I want to turn to you, Mike Miller. You're the economist. Is somebody going to lose something? I mean, do we have to lose things to get ahead as a nation?
Well, I think the fear that I would have is that the government believes it can make decisions which I don't think it can ever have the information necessary to make. And for some reason, we've gone to this place where the government believes that any time there's anybody's feeling hurt or troubled, that the government's job is to make sure that that goes away. And I think that this idea that there would be this group of people that would try to make these decisions for all the rest of us is the problem. And that's why we were having some discussions at break. I think it does come down to this idea of what the Constitution does, which is protects us from the government, and it has limited and enumerated powers. The government should only be doing certain things. And if they would keep within those certain things, I think some of this fear we would have of being watched and being trying to be taken care of, and then asking me for the money to take care of people who pretty much, in some cases, have thrown their own lives away, not through any action that I've been, that's my fault or whatever. I think that they get this resentment. I think that also helps explain the yelling between the two sides.
Have we reached a point where those people who have made bad decisions in their life, John, they have to pay some consequence for that decision.
That's, you mean like drugs or alcoholism?
Anyone.
Or
dropping
crime
out of high
or,
school?
Dropping
right,
out
right.
of okay. There. Well, I
or
mean,
or not saving enough money so that in their golden years they're going to have a dramatic cut
well,
in their cost,
I,
way
I,
they live
I don't
their
know,
lives.
I don't know that I could you know condemn somebody for not having saved enough money. I mean, there are all kinds of circumstances that can intervene in a person's life, and they may have the best intentions, and they may not be especially profligate with their money, but they may not end up with enough at the end.
So
but
that in, so that's life.
So that's life. But in
so,
terms
so,
of
but
is
so
that my problem
is it his problem?
Well, it's society's problem certainly.
Oh, that you not starve on the street. Yes, that's. But how much must I give? Well, if you make bad decisions, how much must I give of my money to cover your mistakes?
Sure. Well, I think you see this through every industry, the health insurance industry. You know, should I be responsible for your bad diet? And should I be paying a higher car insurance premium for the people who choose
well,
to
we
drive?
Well, we don't, and that's why we
insurance. But we
that's
do.
That's what insurance does.
But
insurance
so
is the original
have
social
right,
really.
That's right. And so for instance, risk. You know, think about yeah. Social Security disability income. You know, that's a valuable program, and
oh,
there's some people who are disabled,
absolutely.
And they're never going to be able to generate the type of income somebody
absolutely.
Else may be able to. So those programs, I think,
sure.
are valid, right? But when you said, you know, people are going to have to come off the bus, Bruce, the people I want to get off the bus are GE, ConAgra. You know, people are receiving these government subsidies that are often masquerading as research and development money. Some of it is. Some of it's valid. But there's a lot of money going in the form of tax breaks to big businesses.
Let's talk about something a little more specific. I mean, kicking somebody off the bus. Obama and the Republicans have talked about means testing. Some of these social programs. The original intention is that they were insurance programs, and insurance programs are not means tested. But on the other hand, if you buy automobile insurance and you have a $1,000 deductible, you have in effect set up a means test for yourself in that policy. In terms of Medicare, if a person is lucky enough to retire with $100,000, $150,000, $200,000 income from securities and investments, perhaps there's not a reason he should be eligible for all the benefits of Medicare. Perhaps he should be kicked up to some sort of a catastrophic level of insurance.
Do you agree with that, Bruno?
I think I've said it many times, quite frankly, Bruce, on this show when I've been lucky enough to be on. I think all of us should put everything on the table and talk about it like rational people. And instead, you've got the and I'm going to throw a little bit of salt at the Tea Party here. You've got people on my side of the aisle who are saying, I will scream bloody murder and destroy the political career of anybody who caves on taxes. And then you've got people on the left saying, we will destroy the political career of anybody who caves on changing anything ever at all about Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid. And then you've got people in Rhode Island, Gina Raimondo, who's been fixing the pension system over there and coming up with perfectly reasonable solutions, and she's a Democrat. You've got people, you know, everybody screams about Scott Walker, but he's come up with perfectly reasonable solutions for things that work in Wisconsin. And everybody wants to ignore the fact that there are solutions that are there, and this maybe coming back to Boehner is like maybe that's what Boehner is talking about. It's like, well, if we just sit down and figure this stuff out, we can avoid a catastrophe. But what usually happens is what in Illinois is the canary in the coal mine here is that the political class just keeps on kicking the can down the road until you have a real catastrophe, which we're about to experience in a state like this.
But again, when you talk about the Tea Party, or when you're talking about those that have the loudest voices on the left. What role, John McDonough, does the media play? Because the media likes to go after the people with the biggest microphone and the biggest mouth. It isn't necessarily the people who have thought and speak in a reasonable way. And so they perpetuate and they build up and they expand and they give power to people that maybe are not they're only thinking about their ratings, or they're only thinking about their personal popularity, not the good of the country.
Yes, well,
media, all media, has always done that.
Well, when you throw two extremists from the opposite ends of the spectrum together, you're going to get a wrestling match, and that's what looks good on television and radio. I mean, you do it to
unless
a
you have a
degree here.
Unless
but
you,
this is a very commodious
unless, that's
group,
what I'm
really.
Unless you, I mean, we've had quite a bit of agreement here. We probably have had more agreement with
we could
maybe not everything that Mike may not have agreed with everything.
Bruce, I think we could pretty much run the country from this table.
You could, unfortunately,
and you break the tie.
Unfortunately, I can see your ratings going down right now, though.
Well, I don't think that we are out of time for hour number one. We are going to be back for hour number two. The foursome will all be back, and I'll be there as well. And again, if you're listening to the program on radio, in the next hour, we're going to be talking about education. We're going to focus the whole hour, the next hour, about education and choice in education and vouchers and charter schools and all things related to that. So if you were a teacher, if you're a student, if you care about the future of the country from an educational standpoint, stick around. We're going to hopefully continue the level of this discussion in the next hour. If you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Bruno Barron, Mark Casello, John McDonough, and Mike Miller. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. And for the next hour, we're going to be talking about education. We talk about it off and on this program, have for the last 30 years. And tonight, for the next hour, we're going to focus on at least a movement, at least one member of our panel this evening has very strong feelings about, and that's Bruno Barron. Bruno, nice to have you with us.
Always
you are
a pleasure to
be on. Senior fellow with the Heartland Institute, which is a libertarian
free market think tank. Yeah.
Free market think tank. Okay. Let me ask you the key question. If we could make you or hand you a magic wand and you would wave your magic wand, what would you do to completely transform public education in the United States?
I would begin the process of dismantling the what I call the government education complex, which is a vast complex of the DOE, large players, 14,000 school districts, 50 state boards of education. I would begin the process of dismantling that, and I would reallocate the resources. So instead of funding school districts and funding bureaucracies, we funded children. And that funding, and then what would happen is we would also at the same time create a vast new array of independent education options instead of the only option that you have today, which is either A, a private school if you can afford it, or B, a government school.
Does the Department of Education perform any meaningful function?
I hesitate to say that. The typical quick conservative answer is to say no, it doesn't perform a meaningful function. The fact is that there are probably programs, there are probably things that it does that help some people somewhere with getting a little bit better access. But since we've had the Department of Education in the early, I think it's the 60s, we have not seen any benefit from it. We've only seen much more money going into education with flatline results at best.
John McDonough, as one of our card-carrying liberals tonight, would you say, giving a grade to public education, what grade would you give the success of public education over the last 30 to 40 years?
Oh, up where I come, it gets an A. But
which is in the North Shore of Chicago.
Which is in the North Shore of Chicago. Other parts of the metropolitan area, not so good.
So is the issue here more about parents than it is about teachers?
Well, you know, it might be about the students. Everybody talks about the teachers and the parents, but it's the students who are being taught, and perhaps in some cases it's the students who are resisting the process of education for one reason or another. And maybe we don't put enough
blame, if you want to use the word, on the students.
But again, the students...
Are they blameless?
Let's ask Mike Miller from DePaul University. Mike, I know you've got strong feelings on this. You are a teacher at the college. When we're talking about young students going into a system, those young students are coming from a home.
That's correct.
And homes should be providing some input and some direction to a student.
That's right.
And if you talk to a teacher who have gotten the brunt of all the criticism over the last 40 years, they would argue that, you know, it's the quality of the students that are coming to see us, and it's the quality of the parents that are sending them. They don't care anymore.
Well, I get your point about the students, but I think of it in the more general sense of the family. And there was a book I read several years ago by John McWhorter, who's at the Manhattan Institute.
Linguist.
And it had, he's a linguist, very smart man. And he argued about anti-intellectualism. And whoever takes this position, they just don't succeed. If you believe that, say, going to school, and he's a black man, and he referred to it as acting white, that people said, you always act white and you talk white. What a silly thing to believe. And so I see it if the family... Even if it's a single mom who's trying to raise a couple of kids, if they very much embrace the notion of education, not all children are bright. Not all children are smart. We agree with that, right? Mm-hmm. And therefore, some children are going to be very difficult to educate. Of course, they should also be given education which matches the way that they learn. And the idea that everybody has to go to college, that's a silly idea. That students should be, you know, I can do this and I can be very productive in terms of society.
Mark, I want to ask you. Mark Casello also joins us. Mark, Bruno has said that he doesn't think there's a federal role in education. Do you agree with that, or should there be a federal standard so that the students that are being taught in Alabama are being taught a core curriculum that the people and students in Alaska, Illinois, and California are taught?
In countries where there is a strong centralized education system, Finland, China, students perform better, but I don't know if that's necessarily a statistically valid correlation. My personal belief is if you want to fix education, you have to start by fixing the economic situation of the parents. There's not enough attention paid to that. Economist Stephen Levitt from the University of Chicago did an in-depth statistical analysis and discovered that the economic situation of the parents, more than any intervention, more than moving to another school, is what was already predeterminative of a student's success. Because of some of these cultural issues, such as understanding the importance of education, having a intellectual curiosity rather than
But the economic condition of a parent is frequently determined by how many children they have.
Sure.
And if they have too many children that they can't care for, or a parent leaves the family, then what is government to do, or what is society to do about that?
Sure. Well, what I would suggest would be that the private sector needs to take a greater role in offering some support for its employees in the form, for example, I was the benefit of a tuition reimbursement program when I was attending college. Tuition reimbursements is a low-cost benefit that improves the lives of workers, improves the retention.
But what about the core thing of what's happening in the classroom? We're getting into big, issues above, and there is no singular answer to where we start on this particular issue.
Right.
But let's bring it back to the classroom, the teacher, the students, and the parents.
Leaving in place all of the things that have been said up to now with the background and the socioeconomic status, it's no surprise that people that grew up on the North Shore have access to a better education and, quite frankly, probably at some level better parenting. But leaving all that aside, if you start looking at the way to fix the system, you start realizing that the existence of a Cleveland Department of Education or a Chicago Public Schools, the existence of a massive bureaucracy that believes that it can somehow gain economies of scale and educate children in a very, very bad and diverse set of circumstances, it's absurd. You smack a $10,000 check or a $7,500 check on the forehead of the child or stick it in their backpack, and you say, go and find the best education for your child in this area at this time at a vast new array of independent resources. And the fact is that the real cost of education, the delivery of knowledge, the ability of people to teach that knowledge, the software that's available, there are vignettes, there are stories all across America that indicate that if you just free up the system and de-bureaucratize it, it will benefit everybody across the board.
Report. When we come back, I not only want to hear from everybody around the table, but I want to hear from everybody listening and watching the broadcast this evening. 1-800-723-8289. If you were to begin the process of picking public education apart. From Redding, Pennsylvania to Redding, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, and let's head to Redding, California, where Bryant is listening to us on KQMS, our first caller. Go ahead tonight.
Oh, good evening, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hey, one of the things, you know, about education is, one, the federal government's got to get out of it. The basic family unit is the building block of all society. And their tax policies, their education policies, have all affected the family unit to the point now where you have a lot of single-parent families. It was originally the idea of the, not only of Scripture, but also of the founding government, that the parents were the ones in charge of the schooling of the children.
But Brian, let me interrupt you just for a second, okay? Because you're talking about what the founding fathers wanted or the way things were in society. The reality today is there are too many single parent families. Not enough of the family unit of, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago is no longer a fact of life in America. So when you say letting a parent have more input, how much more input do you want that parent to have in the school? It seems to me the input that is most needed by a parent doesn't have anything to do with what happens at school. It has everything to do with what happens in the home where that parent is raising that child. And they are either watching television or doing their hair, or they're reading a book or helping their children with homework, or they're not. And if they're not, all the money in the world is not going to make that a student a success when they walk into a classroom. At least I don't think so.
Well, to a certain extent, that is true. But what I'm talking about is the fact that a lot of times what happens is, like here in California, for instance, you now have instruction on homosexuality. Now you have instruction on various psychological methods. One thing they did right was that, you know, kindergarten starts at age six, five and a half, six, instead of four and a half, five, because boys, who are the primary the ones who are more likely diagnosed with ADHD, they're not ready for school before age five in most cases. We started, you know, by the time a kid starts at preschool, Head Start, and everything else, by the time they reach 16 years of age, they've been in school for almost 14 years. They're practically burnt out by the time they reach their sophomore year of high school.
Well,
all right, let's let Bruno respond.
I think what Bryant is raising a very interesting point, and where you said you gave a situation, Bruce, where, you know, all the money in the world isn't going to help this kid or this parent, and I would also add to that, perhaps a counterpoint, all the centralization in the world isn't going to help that child or that parent either. We've been centralizing education for the last 50, 60, 70 years, and we've had more social pathologies, less cohesion in family units and communities. So let me just give an example really quickly.
Can I ask you one quick question?
Sure, yeah.
One of the reasons why we were doing that was because certain states didn't take their educational responsibility as seriously as other states. And so the idea that the federal government could come in and set, at least in some standards, a basic standard that everyone should meet, conceptually, wasn't that a good idea? Maybe in practice it's not.
Well,
but conceptually,
the problem conceptually, anything works, and we can all look at Finland and say, "Isn't Finland wonderful?" As Mark just did, and Finland does have very good numbers. The fact is that Finland is basically 4.5 million white lapsed Lutherans who all think the same way, and centralization works in that kind of a culture. Here we have 315 million of the most diverse, spread out, all across the country, different cultures, different states. And I'm not trying to say we're all atomized, but the really quick point I wanted to make is this is how choice specifically helps that woman that you're talking about. If you have a vast new array of independent education resources, someone over here is going to a charter, someone over here is going to a different charter, someone over here is going to a good public school, but someone over there is doing some digital learning along with some tutoring and some other options. If the money becomes allocated to the child, what's going to happen is even the parent who doesn't have as much knowledge or care as another parent down the street, that parent is going to benefit from the dramatic improvements in the system because they're going to say, well, gosh, where's everybody else sending their kid? Oh, they're sending them here. And you start coupling some of the money follow the child concepts with some of the economic things you can do with saving, you know, creating education savings accounts, and you're talking about a situation where even the most disengaged parent – even their child is still going to get a good education. And quite frankly, prior to all the centralization, that's how our public schools used to work.
I guess the question is, how can you guarantee that they're going to get a better education? Because if the parent is still the same, if the parent is not a parent that's going to read to their kids, and suddenly government or someone is going to give them a voucher where they can send their kid to any school, what confidence do you have that that parent is going to put enough effort into making a correct decision to send their child to a good school? Why aren't they going to send it to just the local school because it's only a block away and they don't have to get up early to drive their kid to school even though it may not be a good school? They're going to take the easy way out because they are irresponsible.
Excellent question, and I'll try and answer it as quickly as possible. Number one, Milwaukee has already demonstrated that when they went to a voucher system, the public schools in Milwaukee improved. And this is standard market theory. It still works. Those schools had to improve to keep the children, and that's one way the parent benefits. Here's another way that parent benefits. I can't guarantee, and too many people on the voucher side of things said, if vouchers are a panacea, they'll be perfect. That's not the point. I can't guarantee that every parent everywhere is going to make the right decision, but one thing I can guarantee you is that more parents in more places, with once empowered, will do better than relying on what we already see. If there's one thing that everybody at this table probably agrees on, it's that the bureaucratized urban inner city school is failing so miserably that a voucher system couldn't possibly on any planet be worse.
Do you agree with that, Mark?
Well, my problem with the voucher system is that I feel like it kicks the can down the road. You've got these charter schools. It takes years to develop a curriculum that's effective, for teachers to develop a cohesive team, for schools to be led by these principals. So you have the energy and this impetus behind a charter when it's first created, but that quickly fades away, and you're still left dealing with some of these problems. When you're talking about school choice, parents who are you know, Bruce, you said, well, some parents would just take the easy way out, choose a school nearby. But the students who tend to do better, it's because their parents were already invested to make that choice already.
And by the way, the parent who takes the easy way out is not going to be reading and helping them with their homework. So I'm not so sure that they're going to be any better off.
But their school's a parent is
different. But if the school they go into, understand one thing about competition, it makes everybody better, because if you're going to be at the bottom, you're going to lose. No one will go to you. So the fact that there will be all these better schools, even the public schools, there will still be a public school. Would you agree?
I think there will be some version of what would be called a public school. I'd like to see them all charterized.
Well, say there's this basic public school that you can go to if you wish, and you'll get you won't have to pay anything. Everything this covers the entire thing. To me, this school will have to be better, or no one will go to them.
But what can be done, though, to make that public school better? And those that would argue, in fact, for many years, I argued the point is that any dollar that you do not put into education is a waste. It's a waste. That education and improving public education should be absolutely something that someone should be guaranteed if they're born in this country. They should be able to go to a school where they get a quality education, and they should be safe. And it should be a building with air conditioning. And I know that sounds crazy.
No,
it should
fine.
Have air conditioning. Mm-hmm. And the leak and the roofie, the roof should not be leaking. And the textbook should be current.
Well, Bruce, that's a wonderful exposition of a wish list, and I will admit that there have been times, probably when I was going to public school and maybe right before that, where American public schools seem to be fulfilling that notion. But I still think that the way you just put that is much narrower than it needs to be. Why, if we can guarantee that every child gets a good education, why do we need to guarantee it inside a specific school in a specific system with a specific district and a specific name? Why not just guarantee that they get a good education? And if we can do that, I can give you 10 or 15 better ways. One is
do we need schools?
Yes, we. Yes. Some people
need a building? Do we? I mean, it's the 21st century. Do we need a building where 25 to 35 students get together with the teacher, or can it be done?
Some people
digitally?
Don't. Why force them? Some people don't. Why force them? Can I give you sure. I'll give you a 40-second story. I'll try and do this very quickly. The same guy who's trying to give computers to all the kids did a test, and they developed a tablet computer. And it just came in a box. The directions were on the box. They put it on a mountaintop town in Ethiopia with no school. And they basically just told the grown-ups to open the box for the kids, and the kids would turn it on. The minute the kids turned it on, the only software that was on these things was reading software. No school, no teacher. They came back a month later. All the kids were literate. I mean, they were all at reading level from the software on the tablet. And so what I'm asking everybody to do is disabuse yourself let's not get rid of the brick and mortar school. Let's just not say that's the only way to get educated. Let's say that there's a million ways to get educated, and let's get away. This is one of my favorite quotes, but I love using this. Let's get rid of the 19th century model that we have, and let's just skip the 20th century and jump right into 21st century schooling, which will have some brick and mortar, some charters, some tutors, and some digital.
John, 30 seconds response.
Well, you said Milwaukee vouchers made the public schools better.
Yes.
Did they improve the teachers' performance? I mean, how did they do that?
You know, the studies that you can go and read, they basically just do the whole thing, looked at test scores. So my answer to that, without having citing the specific outcomes of the study, would say that the moment the teachers knew, the moment the schools knew that they were going to potentially be losing students, they immediately said, we have to do something better. And whether it was letting the teachers have more autonomy, or whether it was making the teachers do a better job of teaching to the test, which is one of the problems that we seem to be having these days, I can't really tell you exactly what.
Got a pause. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Mark Casello is here. He is with Calumet College of St. Joseph, where he is an associate professor of radical English. And he joins us tonight. Also has been a contributor to the Huffington Post and was involved in covering the Occupy Wall Street movement. He's the closest thing to a Democrat that we have here. Not the closest thing to a Democrat, but you're more. But you don't like to be called a Democrat, right?
Right.
I'm more of a progressive, a liberal.
Yeah, progressive, a liberal, a leftist.
Leftist. Okay, bomb thrower. Also joining us this evening is Bruno Behrend. Bruno Behrend is he is the senior fellow of the Heartland Institute. And again, tonight he's talking about his pet topic, which is public education and transforming it with voucher systems, charter schools, and anything different than what is being described as institutional or government education in the United States. John McDonough joins us. He is the editor of the Encyclopedia of Advertising for many years. He was a writer with the Chicago Tribune and also comes out of the advertising world himself.
And Democrat.
I'll take the hit. And he is a proud Democrat and also a great raconteur on a variety of subjects, including the history of American broadcasting. Also joining us this evening is Mike Miller. He is an associate professor of economics for 30-plus years?
32
years at DePaul University, hails from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. We're talking about education and what can be done to sort of pick education apart. In the last segment, I talked about the role that computers and digital-related enhancement can come. And I guess a question I would ask you to give sort of an assessment, Bruno, is to what extent are American public schools today, are they up to speed with, no pun intended, up to speed with 21st century computer digital technology?
Well, my first critique is that I just said it right before the break. They're operating on a 19th century model. So, you know, if you're fitting a 21st century product into a 19th century model, you're just you know, it's like, why not just put a horse and buggy in front of that hot Mercedes you just bought and cart it around?
But you also quoted a recent study,
right,
that was funded in Chicago, and briefly describe that to the audience, because it's
this goes right back to the parental and the some of the social issues we were discussing a minute ago. There's a professor, and I think his name is List, at University of Chicago, and this was profiled in a few different magazines. He got a lot of funding from a local hedge fund guy, and he's now into the second or third year of a 10-year longitudinal study. And it basically said this is his theory. If you focus on the parents, if you give the parents enrichment, it will do more for the child than if you enrich the school, if you throw all kinds of fancy pools or pensions or whatever you want to do, throw at the school. And 2 or 3 years into this longitudinal study, they basically have the control group, which gets, you know, nothing. They stay the same. They have a bunch of the kids that are going to fancy new schools, better classrooms, much better equipped, higher paid teachers, so on and so forth. And then you have these other people. What they're doing is they're basically saying, here's the parents. We're going to tell the parents the parents go to the classes. They get paid to go to these classes. Their education classes, enrichment, their how to live your life classes. And what their early results are showing, that it's a runaway winner to focus on the parents in these neighborhoods, in the most needy neighborhoods.
Because a parent is the most important teacher in a child's life.
No one disputes that.
And they're motivated enough to do this.
And obviously this is a study, so they have a nice big pile of benefits that they can give to each of these things. But I think what we're looking at here is that no one is arguing that the parents don't matter, or if you just go to this system. As I said earlier, I'm not saying that vouchers are a panacea. I'm just saying that if you move to a more choice-based system, more charters, more vouchers, more opportunities for different kinds of education institutions, you stand a much better chance to improve outcomes broadly for children.
Well, one of the things that I want to just make a case for, and I've talked about it on this program for a number of years, is that, and it gets back to, as you say, it's the bricks and mortar. Maybe this is the 20th century element. I mean, the amount of money that has been spent and the property in the United States that is a public school of some, or an educational institution, is that you look at that infrastructure that is just massive throughout the United States, and you make those schools, they don't close at 3:15 in the afternoon. They're open 18 hours a day. And they become not just a place where students can go and young people can go to be educated. It's for adult education. It's where parents can go. Maybe parents go to school with their children after work. So that the school, which includes a library where students can learn, but it's open 18 hours a day. And it's taking a resource and making it a viable community center for those that can join together in a family unit and learn, maximizing the efficiency of all that investment that's there. And again, adding the quality teachers, but building on what you're just saying, is you're educating the parents. What we have here is we have too many irresponsible parents, and they're having children, and they're not taking care of their children. It is at the core of every single social ill we have, is irresponsible people having children and not taking care of them.
It's part of it, and I don't want to hog the microphone here. I'll just say this. Back in, 50, 70, 80, 100 years ago, we had somewhere around 200,000 school boards, which was that community independent school that you are idolizing making it a mythological entity. Right now, we have 14,000 school districts. That wonderful image that you just gave us, that's not going on in the infrastructure of the Chicago public school system. I am all with you, Bruce. Break up that school system, make that school a community school, and make that community school run by the people in that community, and then I'll take you seriously. Well, CPS can't do it.
I agree with that. I'm not talking about the bureaucracy. I'm talking about the concept of the actual buildings. Mark.
But how do you start to make this happen? For instance, in Chicago, I don't know if the listening public nationally knows this, but we do not have an elective school board here in Chicago. It's an appointed school board. So those very communities who would love Bruce's idea of having a community center in that educational institution, they don't have a voice, a direct voice to make those decisions. We've got buildings that have been shut down. Schools are being closed down. And these great facilities that could be used by the city are being shut down and handed off to...
Look what happened when the mayor of Chicago, when Rahm Emanuel wanted to extend the school year, the teachers' union went nuts because they had to stay at school
it wasn't just about extending the school day. If you extend a substandard school day to 10 hours, you just have 10 hours of substandard torture for these poor students. So what we need is an effective 6-hour school day. The students would love it. And so how do you do that? And I think you're right, getting better local control of the schools.
John.
One question. In terms of decentralizing the educational system, what kind of central accreditation authority would you have to ensure that there was fairly equal access to standards of literacy and math and history and so on?
Just as I think there should be an open market in education, I think there should be an open market in accreditation.
The marketplace?
Absolutely. Right now, I mean, let's look at what we have as accreditation. We've got we've got standardized tests, the ISAT. Now we've got also the ACT. We have the PSAT. We have the SAT.
Those are college entrants.
Well, those are college entrants, and then you have your yearly tests. Mm-hmm. One of the fantastic concepts that's coming up right now, particularly, again, with these 21st century things, why shouldn't every child be able to log in and have their own portfolio, which they kind of have with dioramas and things like that right now. But why shouldn't every single child have a portfolio, and then you just have a series of merit badges? Do they know long division? Check. Can they add? Do they know their multiplication table? Check. And instead of having this massive testing bureaucracy and the ETS, which is another one of the big private interests that's making a lot of money off of public education, all of a sudden all of this becomes an organic opportunity for, like, well, let's go check that child's thing. Do we have permission to look at your assessments? Yes, you do. You go on. Line, you look at their assessments, and all of a sudden, you could even, I mean, why can't we make accreditation as open source and as fantastic as we have an entrepreneurial society that creates all our products for us? I think it's a great vision.
Wouldn't that lead to differing standards, though? So that the student in Alabama may have a different standard than somebody in Nebraska.
Decentralizing the FDA, Drug Administration.
Well, everybody wants. This goes right back to the slippery slope argument. I'm not arguing to get rid of all standardization immediately. What I'm saying is, let's have a different vision for education. And for example, I got to tell you, Bruce, I would hope that someone in Alabama wants to have a slightly different view of the world and a slightly different take on the world than every single person in America's white suburbs. And I would say the same for the black community. I mean, if we trust words like diversity, then let's have some diversity instead of just saying, well, we really talk about diversity as long as it's diversity of color and diversity of sexual orientation, but there can be no diversity in testing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's absurd.
But I think the problem is that it's too easy for a government, a local government, to sort of wash their hands of education by turning it over to a private for-profit charter school. So it's hard for those two things to exist. So you have communities where they want to keep their public school open, but that competition from charter schools for the city officials, they want to close those schools down.
Well, I totally agree with you on the issue of the administration and all of the school districts. I mean, if we tried to break up school districts in the state of Illinois, and again, it was not an easy task. I mean, everybody has their own fiefdom; they want to fight for it. It's their turf, and they don't want to give it up. So again, you have duplication of effort in a lot of cases.
Mark made an excellent point. Now, quite frankly, way back in 1988, Illinois had an education reform where we actually had local school councils. They didn't have any power, but if you gave them power, and they're, you know, I'm not saying we want to atomize everything.
With varying success.
Varying success.
You got applause. 1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we do have callers on the line, and we will bring them into the conversation. Thanks for joining us tonight. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's go to Goshen, Indiana, where Stuart is listening to us on WoWo tonight. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. I heard several of you talking about states' responsibilities and parents' responsibilities, and it always seems like as soon as we start talking about parents that it it gets shifted and diverted over to the curriculums and the schools and the unions and the teachers and everything. But at some point, the core issue needs to be addressed of the parents, and it seems like as a society we are starting to reward irresponsibility, and there's really no consequence. If they have more kids, well, okay, now we got to give them more money. And when do we start really teaching the parents that, you know what, it's not a fundamental right that your kid gets to go to college for free. These are the issues that you have to address if you want more in life. Maybe you shouldn't get TV and cell phones and computers. This is what you have to do to achieve those things.
Stuart, let me ask you this, however. All right, we will acknowledge there are irresponsible parents. Irresponsible parents sometimes have children. Sometimes those children turn out to be irresponsible. At what point do you say to the child of an irresponsible set of parents, do you say to that child, you don't have a right to go to a quality school?
No, I would say they talked about opening it up to the private sector. I would say there are many organizations that would love to teach kids. That would be their pursuit of happiness, their joy in life, would be teaching kids the fundamentals without charging high dollar prices, and start telling them this is what you got to learn if you want something different in life.
Is there, again, this can open Pandora's box here, but let's ask for it. And that is, you know, we're talking about public education or education this evening. But I don't know, and we've talked about the responsibility of parents and whether parents are responsible or irresponsible. But it seems to me that there is a greater, more defined role for religion. Not any particular religion, but religion in general, because religion also can be an integral part of teaching responsibility, not only to parents, but also to children. Would you acknowledge that?
I would certainly agree. At least the scripture, the Bible, would certainly talk about that as far as consequences and so forth. And that's kind of the whole point, is the public school has gotten away from the important things in life, and now they're focused on sports, and they're focused on all these social things, and they're no longer focusing on education and really telling the students, this is what you have to know in order to get a job, in order to not video games, not television, not this other stuff, and no one's really saying that and putting responsibility back on the parents with consequences. It's the opposite, but we're rewarding it.
Yes, well, some of those things are brought on by culture. I do. We're going to take another call. Thank you for your call. I do want to ask Mike a question, because Mike, before the break, acknowledged that you were a graduate of parochial education.
That's correct. Catholic education.
When you were going through Catholic education in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, did you know during that time period that you were probably getting a better education than your buddies down the street?
Not until I went to high school. And when I went to high school, it was a Catholic boys' high school, and we had to apply and we had to be accepted. And if we were not accepted, we had to go to what was called Oliver High School in north side of Pittsburgh. And my friends who went to Oliver, this was in 1968. This was one of what we would call an era of the race riots, one of the first race riots in Pittsburgh. I looked at a good friend of mine, Frank, and he just fell away from education. And it was, I blame the school. He went to school. He completely changed because he became angry, and race became such a major issue, he being white, and the kids who calling the what he thought were causing the trouble were being black. And in high school, I saw a distinct difference between what I got being at the Catholic boys' school versus what I would have gotten had I gone to the public school.
And what were you being taught? What was the educator at your school teaching you that their colleague at another school was not teaching your friend Frank?
You came to school, you dressed. We had to wear a coat and tie. If you got out of line, you got a whack. I mean, whacking, I think, is not a great idea. But the brothers, these
and
were Marist.
And your parents paid for it.
Well, yes. I actually had a paper route.
What was the racial environment at the school?
It was about 2% black.
Mm. Just the opposite of what your friend went to.
Exactly right. It was, but they did not. It was a case that there were so few black Catholics.
No, I understand.
Now, the thing is that as time went on, by the time I was a senior, there were many more black students that were there, and they never once discriminated. They never said, you can't come. And it turned out one of the two black kids that I went all 4 years with, his father was a surgeon. My old man was a drunk plumber. And so it was the difference was what happened in the room. We were expected to be there. We were expected to do our homework. If we got out of line, they took us out and they lectured us and sometimes whacked us.
Well, yours was a school that could cherry pick the students that it wanted.
Yeah, that's correct.
The public school doesn't have that luxury.
That's correct. I understand that that made a difference.
And the cherry picking argument is there's some truth there, but the fact is that all the charter studies are not about cherry picking because the charter schools
can't
cherry pick.
That's
they literally
right.
have to go by lottery. So public schools and private schools. I mean, obviously, if you move into a really wealthy suburb, or if you pay twice in your taxes and other things, then you're cherry picking in that way. But the caller, we cannot try and do every social palliative through our education system. That's one of the problems we're running into.
Before we go off, I'm going to give you an opportunity to give your website if people want to get in touch with you. That was Bruno Barron. Also joining us this evening, let me mention our Democrats, although they were all engaged in a sort of a nonpartisan discussion this past hour. Again, Mark Casello has been with us, and also John McDonough has been with us, and also representing the other side has been Mike Miller from DePaul University, and Bruno Barron has been sort of leading this discussion. He is the senior fellow of the Heartland Institute. If people quickly want to know more about what your passion is, which is improving education, where can they go?
There's two websites. One is obviously heartland.org. And they're right there on the front page is the banner that talks about all the education issues, if that's the one that you're most interested in. And then there's another website that we have called theparenttrigger.com, which specifically talks about the parent trigger reform that's taking over the nation right now.
Bruno, we are out of time. Thank you all for being with us. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thank you very much for being with us. So this program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.